Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about welfare reform and look back a bit to the law that was enacted in 1996, at the time when a lot of people were saying that welfare, as we knew it, didn't work and it needed to be changed. Certainly the president at the time, Mr. Clinton, said that, and there were a lot of people in Congress that agreed. This law was enacted, and it brought a number of very important and fundamental changes to the way welfare, that is the financial assistance that was provided to families who needed it, the way that that was provided. And among the basic changes, it required people receiving benefits to work, and it also placed a time limit on the total amount of time that a person could receive benefits. It was at the time controversial. There were some people who weren't sure that was the right way to go, but it did indeed pass. At this point here, we can look back and talk a little bit about just what the result of these reforms have been. And our guest this morning makes the argument that, in fact, they have been positive. His name is Ron Haskins. He's a senior fellow in the Economic Studies Program at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and also is someone who has been around Washington for a long time in various capacities, including serving as the advisor, senior advisor to the president for welfare policy at the White House. He is here visiting the campus. He is taking part in program that's being sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study, the same folks that are responsible for the MillerCom series, and we've had a lot of those speakers here on this program. It's their initiative for 2003-2004, they're calling Who Gets What? The Interactions of Health Policy and Social Welfare Policy. And the idea is they have a number of people here all exploring the same topic, that is the connections between health and social welfare policies. Mr. Haskins was scheduled to talk yesterday and had some travel problems, but he is here now, and his talk has been rescheduled, so it will be taking place this afternoon at 3 o'clock at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. So same place, slightly different time. Questions are certainly welcome if you would like to be involved in the conversation. The only thing we ask of people is their brief when they call in, and we do that to keep the program moving. We'd like to try to get as many different people as possible, but anybody who's interested in calling is welcome to do that. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much.
I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad. I did find myself wondering with yesterday's weather whether you were going to end up getting here at all.
Yeah, I did a lovely tour of the nation's airports, and especially the wonderful Baltimore-Washington International, where I got to spend about 6 hours. So,
well, we're glad to have you here. Do I have it right that you were involved in crafting the reform of 1996?
I was the staff director of the Ways and Means Welfare Subcommittee that wrote the original draft of the legislation. Clay Shaw, who's the chairman from Florida and still is on the Ways and Means Committee, and Bill Archer, who was the chairman of the entire Ways and Means Committee, participated directly as well. And then people tend to have forgotten this, but the actual bill that was signed by President Clinton August 22, 1996, was extremely broad, and there were major changes in Medicaid, food stamps, child nutrition, so a whole range of programs. So there were other committees involved as well, and then all of those various bills that came from the committees of Congress were put together into one monster bill, and that was the bill that passed. So the parts that had to do with cash welfare, supplemental security income, aid for non-citizens, and several other parts I worked on. So I was directly involved in the drafting and working with Clay Shaw and Bill Archer.
Well, it seemed that as I think about it, the part that people really focused on was with this thing that we used to call aid to families with dependent children.
That's correct.
FTC, which then morphed into something else,
right?
That it had a different set of initials,
right?
And that did indeed have these important, fundamental, basic changes in the way that the whole program
correct.
Was structured.
Correct.
So, and this was, I think people do need to recall that this was a bipartisan effort, that it was President
Clinton.
Well,
wait a minute now. Don't go too quickly.
Well, it was at least President Clinton who said that.
Let me give Clinton his due. Right. Clinton initiated the debate during the 92 election with very, very popular phrases. In fact, you may remember this. A lot of Republicans were extremely jealous of Clinton because he ran on many issues that Republicans often run on, not just welfare reform, but crime, balanced budgets.
Right.
I mean, he really stole Republican thunder, new Democrat, so to speak. But Clinton did not do anything the first 2 years. So, I mean, he had a tax force, but a bill was never even brought to the committee level. And then by an astounding coincidence, Republicans took over the House for the first time in 40 years and won back the Senate. So Clinton was president, and Republicans controlled the House and Senate.
Right.
The battle in the House especially was extremely partisan. It's one of the most partisan debates that I've seen in 20 years in Washington. And the accusations against Republicans and against the bill were really enormous. The frequent comparisons to Nazi Germany. I mean, it was really, really a nasty debate. In the Senate, though, and the bill was different by degrees, the debate was quite friendly. Senator Moynihan, who almost everybody regarded now, unfortunately, has died, but almost everybody regarded him as the greatest expert on welfare that has ever been in the House or the Senate, and it's true. He hated the bill, and his rhetoric was really very strong, in fact, against the president as well, because he was afraid the president would eventually sign the bill. But still, the bill passed the Senate by an overwhelming majority. So in the end, though, when Clinton said he would sign the bill, what happened is we sent him the bill, he vetoed it. We sent it back again, he vetoed it again. And then the third time we sent it, in July of 1996, he signed it. So at that point, the last bill that went through, half the Democrats on the Hill supported it. So it was a highly bipartisan bill in the end, but it started out being extremely partisan.
Well, the man who said we were going to change welfare as we know it, if it had not been for the Republican victories in 94, when they get control of the House, do you think then, in fact, that would not have happened?
It would not have happened.
If you had had Democrat Congress, it wouldn't have happened.
It would not have happened. Now, I am not trying to take anything away from Clinton. Clinton on welfare is a great president, in my opinion. And he's initiated this debate. On most of the major issues, we agreed with Clinton, or he agreed with us, however you want to put it. There were some differences. So he deserves a great deal of credit. But the problem that he was in is that he could not have passed the kind of bill that he said he favored, that he ran for president on and was elected, in a Democratic Congress. He might have been able to get something through the Senate, but the House was too dominated by liberals to pass the kind of bill. And they were the committee chairman. Gephardt was the senior Democrat. So he would have had a hard time passing the bill. It's an irony that he was actually enabled to deliver on his campaign promise because Republicans were elected to the House and the Senate.
Well, what, from your perspective, what do you think about this bill was? What was it that Democrats most objected to?
There are many things, but we're fortunate that there's one key idea that I think is really the essence, and I think it captures the whole nature of the debate. And incidentally, it also captures the nature of the change that we have gone through in this country. And you can summarize it in one word, and the word is entitlement. The idea of policy before the welfare bill passed is that low-income people were entitled to benefits. And specifically, they were entitled to cash, to food stamps, and to Medicaid. And that package of benefits was worth about $12,000 in the average state. And by entitled, I mean, if they met the qualifications, they got the benefit. It was a legal right, and if they didn't, they could go to court and get the benefit. What Republicans wanted to do was to leave Medicaid. There was a big debate over Medicaid, but in the end, Medicaid was left more or less intact. There were some changes in it, but it was left intact. Food stamps left intact, was cut back some, but left intact. Both still entitlements. But welfare, the cash part of this, was no longer an entitlement. So it was a conditional grant of money to a family that agreed in a reciprocal obligation with the state to engage in activities to become independent of welfare. So they would look for work, they would train, they would educate, they would do things specifically prepared for work. And in addition, the states had requirements that they had to have a certain percentage of their caseload involved in these activities, and if they didn't, they would get a sanction. And that was a major change in federal policy. There were sanctions, cash sanctions, on both individuals. They would lose part of the grant, and in over half states, they could lose the entire grant unless they truly committed themselves to try to leave welfare, to prepare to leave welfare and search for jobs. And there were cash sanctions on the states if they didn't have an active program and try to help people leave welfare. So that is the biggest change by far. The other one that you mentioned is the time limit. And the time limit, of course, was a completely new idea. And it really underlines the idea that entitlement is gone, because it says in 5 years you have to leave welfare no matter what. And the reason that's in there is that the Republican vision was that when you come to the Department of Social Services and apply for welfare, you should hear at that time that this is a time-limited program. Indeed, the name of the program changed, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. Mm-hmm. So the idea was, you know from the very first time you come that this is a transitional program. It's temporary. It's to help you get back on your feet, but it's your job to find a job, and we're going to help you do that rather than just give you a check.
Yeah. Well, I think for a lot of people, the key idea here was the United States or the U.S. government or Americans didn't want people to be on welfare forever. That it would be better for people to be working,
right,
to be paying taxes, and so forth. And,
right,
and that was part of the idea of saying, look, there's two things here. We're going to place a cap on, mm-hmm, the amount of time you can receive benefits, and we're going to say what we really want is for you to have a job and,
right,
and to work.
Right.
And indeed, what has happened is the welfare rolls, the numbers of people on welfare has declined. And,
mm-hmm,
some people say, well, see, that's success.
Mm-hmm.
The question that seems in some people's minds, though, to be out there is, well, what happened? Did really all of the people, mm-hmm, that previously were receiving benefits and were on the rolls, did they go off, get jobs?
Right.
Are they managing to make a living wage to support their, mm-hmm, families? Or are there people who simply are gone? They're not on the rolls anymore, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing well and that they're working.
Right. I think we know the answers to these questions from several different sources of information. First of all, more than 40 states have done what are called leaver studies, which means that they followed people once they left the rolls. From those studies, we know that at any given moment, about half the people who leave the rolls actually have a job. They're employed and they're earning money. Over a period of time, about 80% either have a job then or have had a job. So a pattern that's not unusual is that people get a job, they lose a job, they get another job, they lose a job. Sometimes they come back on welfare, then they go off again. So you have that pattern. Now, the second thing that we know, and this is much more important, and it's based on data from the Census Bureau. The Census Bureau does random sampling in the United States, which gives you reliable information about the entire population. And if you look at the bottom 40% of female-headed families, this is all female-headed families below roughly $21,000 in earnings. And, of course, this would include every family on welfare and the overwhelming majority of families that have left welfare. And if you look at that all across the 90s, from before welfare reform and after welfare reform, you see two very striking things. First, starting in roughly 1995, about the time the federal bill passed, income for female-headed families from welfare begins to decline. So that'd be cash, food stamps, and a few other programs. Earnings, plus a credit called the Earned Income Tax Credit that goes to low-income families that have children through the tax code, that increased dramatically. And if you end in 2001, over the period, the combination of the decline in welfare income and the increase in earnings plus earned income tax credit, the average low-income female-headed family was better off by about 20% in constant dollars, so in inflation-adjusted dollars. So they definitely were financially better off. But it is true also what you said. There are some people who left the rolls and did not get jobs or got jobs and lost them. In the old days under welfare and the entitlement system, people could stay on welfare for a very long time, and many, many, many families did. The average length of stay for people on the rolls at any given time was about 10 years. Now, that a lot of people were on and off, but there were people who had 15, 20 years on welfare. So people who were basically incompetent could go on welfare and stay on welfare for a very long time, and they did. Under the new system, they can't do that. So there are people who are not on welfare because of the demanding nature of the new system and the use of sanctions and so forth, and yet they can't hold a job. So that group of people, and that could be 200,000 people or perhaps even more, it's hard to pin down exactly. I call them floundering families. Other people have other terms for it, but they are not in good shape, and it's at least 200,000 families with children. So we shouldn't lose sight of those people. We should try to help those people too, but they are not doing well under the new system. Mm.
I should introduce again our guest for anyone who's just tuned in here. We're talking with Ron Haskins. He's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. His expertise is in a number of areas, including welfare reform, that subject we're talking about here this morning. He has served as senior advisor to the president for welfare policy at the White House, and also before that was part of the Ways and Means Committee in the House, particularly that part that was interested in this issue. And as we explained at the beginning of the program, he was one of those people that was involved in the drafting of this welfare reform legislation that passed in 1996. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk this afternoon. And questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, what more do we know about these families, this 200,000, those people that they came to the end of their benefits? They came to the point where the law says you're not getting any more benefits, and yet are not mm-hmm. supporting themselves. Well, I mean, what happens to them?
Interestingly, they usually do not come to the end of their benefits, to the time limit. Very, very right. few families reach the five-year time limit because of sanctions. The families that would reach the five-year time limit usually get a sanction in the first year, the first 2 years, because they're not actively looking for jobs, they're not fulfilling the responsibilities. And there are families, we don't understand this very well, but there are families that just leave the rolls or don't go on the rolls. And they're floundering, disorganized, you know, disconnected, whatever term you would like to use. Now, we do know something about these families. And thankfully, Health and Human Services, by the way, in the legislation 96, we gave Health and Human Services slightly over $20 million a year to study welfare, its implementation, and associated issues like child care and so forth. And HHS has done a really masterful job. They've done a lot of very, very good studies, and we've learned a lot. And one of the studies that they're engaged in now, we don't have results yet, but they are working with states to identify these families, these floundering families that we're talking about here, and to follow them and to learn about what exactly they're doing, what kind of income they have, how they support themselves, whether the kids are hungry and they have other objective measures. Maybe they're involved with the Department of Social Services because of abuse and neglect issues and so forth. So we will be learning a lot more about these families. There's a study in Michigan that has taught us a fair amount already, and probably the most interesting thing is this. There are a set of barriers that are associated with people not being able to work successfully, and often that means they get a job but they lose it. Or they might get another job, a second job, and they lose that too. So they don't work more than they work. And the barriers are things like addictions, depression, other mental illnesses, having three or more children, having transportation problems, having serious housing problems. So there are a whole list of these things. Now, it turns out if a family has just one of these barriers to employment, they're usually in pretty good shape. They are usually able to make the transition. But if they have two or more of these barriers, then that is when you see the big increase in the chances that they will not be able to successfully make the transition into employment. So we're learning about how to identify those families. So far, we haven't figured out programs that are really able to help them. And that's because, in many cases, our programs for addictions, for example, are not very successful. It takes a long time to cure someone of a drug addiction or alcoholism. Both. It's often a very long-term process. So if that is the problem, you're in for a long ride. Mm-hmm. But we have learned something about these families. I personally think we should be doing more. I wish we would make more research money available, and I wish we would make more money available to the states and to other organizations like universities and Catholic Charities and other organizations that are committed to helping the poor, because the toughest part of the problem are these families that are disorganized and have a difficult time making a transition to support themselves and their children.
Yeah. What happened when the economic downturn of, well, I suppose this was started in 2001,
mm-hmm.
certainly before 9/11, and right. then that just made that much worse. Things, the economy was doing pretty well. I imagine it would have been much easier before that to find work, particularly if you were someone who perhaps had some deficits in skills and work history and education.
Right.
I think a lot of people, when things started to get to turn sour, were starting to think the people who had the most to lose would be the people who were kind of on the bottom. What happened at that point?
If you think about this, it's a very interesting question, because the goal of welfare reform in many respects was to encourage, entice, force, if necessary, low-income families that had become dependent on welfare to become like the rest of America, that is, dependent on labor and on the labor market. And when you're dependent on the labor market, then you are subject to these disruptions, economic disruptions, especially during recessions. So one of the criticisms of the bill way back in 95 and 96 when it passed was there needed to be more provisions in the legislation that would help people during recessions. And there were provisions that were put in legislation, but they were criticized. Now, we have now had a recession. Fortunately, it was a fairly mild recession. And the results, I think, are really that this has been a mild recession, so maybe this won't extend to more serious recessions in the future. But in a word, the impacts have been moderate. Two words, very moderate, surprisingly moderate. I did not mention when I was summarizing results, two things that we know from national data is a dramatic, completely unparalleled increase in low-income mothers heading families that got a job. In a 40-year period, the most disadvantaged of those mothers, the ones that have never been married, so they're less likely to complete high school, less likely to have a work history, and in the past, they were the ones that were likely to go on welfare and stay for many years. They had a 40% increase in employment, and they now are almost as likely as married mothers to have a job. So a huge impact on these mothers that most people thought would not be able to support themselves and their families. And as a result of that, we got the lowest poverty level by 1998 and then again in 99, 2000, the lowest child poverty level for kids who lived in single-parent families in the history of the country. And by the way, the lowest poverty level for African-American children in the history of the country. When the recession came, there was a slight impact, and these mothers were slightly less likely to be employed, about 2 percentage points. And there was a slight increase in child poverty, but it wasn't even significant. So there has been a very, very modest impact, but it's not a major impact by any means. It wasn't the terrible crisis that people thought might happen and could happen in the future in a really serious recession. So that has been very, very good news. And I think what it tells us is that this recession, perhaps more than previous recessions, and by the way, the decline in child poverty in the 2 years following the recession in 2001 is about half of the decline in child, the increase in child poverty is less than half of what had been in the average of the previous three recessions.
So it went up, but it was not as bad as it was before.
Absolutely. So it's very moderate, as I was saying before.
What if you take a look at people, first-time applicants for benefits, was there a significant noticeable increase in those people?
No, in fact, there's a decrease. People are, you would expect that if the message that welfare is only for people who are really in trouble, that you are expected to work and to support your family, you would expect that over a period of years, the applications for welfare would go down. Mm-hmm. And there has been somewhat of a decline in applications for welfare, but what has really happened is that states have changed their programs so that when people apply for welfare, they walk in the office. And it isn't a welfare office anymore where their main goal is to get the amount of the check right. It's an employment office. And they say, we're going to help you find a job. And often they help people find a job. And indeed, they require people to actually look for jobs before they can get welfare. So many people never go on welfare because they get a job.
We have a couple of callers here, and we'd certainly welcome people into the conversation. We're already at our midpoint. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal travels. Also, if you happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Our first caller is in Chicago on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. Excuse me if you already explained this, but the government's program, Aid to Dependent Children, was focused on making sure that children were not in poverty, and it had entitlements for the child, which allowed the family to stay on welfare, I believe, until the child was either 16 or 18. And when you're giving all these statistics, I thought that the Census Bureau had said that the growing group of the group that's fastest falling into poverty are children. So when did the government's focus turn away from protecting children and making sure that they received entitlements to looking at this quote-unquote family?
Okay, I think this is, I would call this a mistaken way of looking at the problem, to think that you could support children without supporting their parents. By far, in any kind of family, at any economic level, the parents are the most important factor in the child's life. And the old system, it was called Aid to Dependent Children. And by the way, the name changed over the years to Aid to Families with Dependent Children because the money did go to the parents. And the parents, usually a single mother, had control of the money. But if you were going to help those kids, you needed to help the parents. And that's what this program has done. The mothers are more likely to be employed. Therefore, their earnings have increased. We subsidize their earnings through their income tax credit. They still get food stamps or other benefits that they're eligible for, especially child care. And they are financially better off. This is very clear from Census Bureau data. So whoever told you that child poverty has gone up, it's just incorrect. Well, until 2002, child poverty declined. It's the first sustained decline in child poverty that we've had since the early 1970s. And child poverty reached almost its lowest level ever. And for black children and Hispanic kids, children, it did reach its lowest level ever because of earnings, not because of government benefits.
My second question, and I will make this very quick, is that with the aid to dependent children, it allowed parents to, at least mothers, to stay in the home and provide a great deal of labor that's involved in raising children. That's not replaced when these women take low-income jobs. What has been the result of that? Has anyone looked at that?
Yes, there are numerous studies, and let me try to summarize studies. We have a lot more to learn about this, and it certainly is a concern. I would say as a philosophy, though, our nation clearly has left the old, a lot of people used to associate this idea with conservatives and Republicans that the mother's place was in a home, and the whole society left that, and the argument that welfare mothers should be able to stay home to rear their children just did not work in a country where lots of single moms were working and paying taxes so that those other mothers could stay home. So that argument, our society just changed dramatically, and there is an expectation that even married mothers will work, and they do work in huge numbers.
No, my question was the labor that the mother...
I understand that.
Well,
your question is what happened to the kids as a result of the mothers leaving
right.
the home. Let me, and I say we have a lot more to learn. For preschool kids, there actually seem to be positive impacts. And the reason probably is that a lot of those children are in fairly good quality child care settings where they are learning things like their numbers, their colors, and so forth, the kind of things that kids learn in Head Start and other quality preschool programs. And as a result, when those children go to school, they're doing a little better in school, their teachers rate them as doing a little better, and their parents rate them as doing a little better as compared with kids of mothers who are still on welfare, and the kids did not go to child care. On the other hand, for older kids, adolescent kids, and particularly for adolescent kids who have younger siblings, it appears that there are some negative effects. There are not huge effects, but they are less likely to do well in school, so their school performance goes down a little bit. And some people think this is because they are carrying additional responsibility at home because their single mother is now in the labor force. But this is not well understood, but I would say that this is a caution flag. I think this is an issue. We need to learn more about it, and we should continue this whole line of studies of examining what happens to the children.
Thank you.
All right. We are, as I said, we're now a little bit past the midpoint. Maybe I should introduce again our guest, and we have some other callers, and we will get right to. Ron Haskins is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., where he's interested in, has done research on welfare reform, among other things. He also has been senior advisor to the president for welfare policy at the White House and was involved in crafting the welfare reforms that were signed into law by President Clinton back in 1996. He's here visiting the campus, taking part in an initiative that's sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study. These are the folks that are also responsible for the MillerCom lecture series, and many of those people appear on this program. This is a year-long initiative that looks at the interconnectedness of health and social welfare policies, and he will be talking about the welfare reform law of 1996 on the U of I campus this afternoon at 3. And the Levis Faculty Center. That's on Illinois Street in Urbana. All of these kinds of programs are also always free and open to the public, and anybody who's interested in hearing what he has to say should feel welcome to stop by. Questions also are welcome on the program, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here standing by. Next is Champagne and Line 1. Hello.
Hello. I was listening to your expert guest recount these rosy statistics about the value of the Welfare Reform Act of 1996. I'm reminded of a Supreme Court decision involving employment discrimination where statistics at that time weighed supreme. That is, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And I'm also familiar with an expression that lawyers often have, that the question of what happened or what happened, it depends on who's answering the question. I really have a serious concern about this. I think it was always designed as a safety net. Knowing how people pay child support, and that goes to parents, that's also a safety net for the child to talk about family and who has to take responsibility for the money to make sure it gets to the child. I think that's a distinction that has no meaning. But my point is, I know two people who I feel are very credible in this issue. Marion Wright Edelman of the Children's Defense Fund and her husband, Peter Edelman, who left the Clinton administration in protest and is now a professor at Georgetown University Law School, a law center. And I wonder how they see this so differently than the guest. And their record, their gravitas on this is, in my opinion, beyond reproach. And they view this and its contribution to added poverty among low-income people, added poverty among children who need it desperately as a crime heaped upon them by one of the richest nations in the world. I'd like for your guest to respond to that.
Okay. I know both Marion Wright Edelman and especially Peter Edelman, who I consider a friend of mine, and Peter and I have appeared at the same forum on many, many occasions. I do not think that Peter claims that there has been an increase in child poverty. It's very difficult to do that because these are government statistics that are nonpartisan. We've kept them for years and years. There are criticisms of the poverty measure itself, but no matter what measure you use to poverty, child poverty has clearly declined until the recession, and there's been a slight increase during the recession. And it is due primarily to the income of the families. So Peter and Marion Wright Edelman both continue to be critical of the bill, and now their criticism is primarily that there should be more money for child care, that we should do a better job of helping these floundering families that I talked about a moment ago, that we should do more about transportation, that child care itself needs to be of higher quality, and so forth. But I think that they have accommodated themselves at least somewhat to the nature of the new system now. And let me add to this. The new system, there is no question, is much more popular with the American people. The American people push this. Part of the brilliance that Clinton had in the election of 92 and part of the reason he was elected was that he was a new Democrat. And the essence of it was, in many respects, that people were expected to support themselves. And he said, we are going to end welfare as we know it. And we are going to help people find jobs, and we're going to change the nature of welfare, and eventually that's exactly what happened. And it is very popular with the American public, no matter what Peter Edelman and Marion Wright Edelman
say. Well, I'm not saying the American public is the benchmark for what good public policy. A lot of things have been popular with the American public in the past, like slavery, which was bad human rights policy. My question to you, however, is irrespective of Clinton, who is or was a populist and would do anything to be elected, including be a new centrist Democrat and a demagogue, quite frankly, my question to you is, why, if this is good, do we continue in this country and the people don't raise outcries about it to have corporate welfare? Obscene form subsidies, obscene corporate subsidies, war profiteering that's going on now in Iraq, and nobody seems to have an outcry about it.
Well, that it certainly isn't true that there is an outcry about it. We regularly have debates in Washington and Congress, and I bet you do right here in the state capitol in Springfield as well, that the wealthy should pay more taxes, that corporations should have more taxes. There's a very conservative organization in Washington called the Cato Institute that every year publishes a volume on corporate subsidies that should be ended. And let me tell you that right now the federal budget is in a crisis, just as we were in the 90s when Republicans and Democrats finally made an agreement and solved the budget crisis. And as a result of that budget crisis and the huge deficits that we are going to have as far into the future as you can see, there is a renewed emphasis on what you called corporate welfare. And I predict there will be changes in the treatment of corporations and possibly individuals. Definitely there will be changes in federal spending programs so that the budget can be brought into balance.
Sir, I'm not as sanguine about that as you, and I think you're being very naive. Thank you.
All right, let's go on to another caller here. We'll go to Urbana, line number two. Hello?
Yeah, what do you know about Latinos and welfare, and in particular illegal aliens and welfare? Are you as confident about your, and also are you as confident about your data there as you are in other segments? Because I'm sure you're somewhat hampered in your ability to collect data, isn't that correct?
Somewhat, but not as much as you might think. Let me say several things. First of all, we did not discuss this earlier, but one of the most dramatic and controversial changes in the legislation was that the legislation, just roughly speaking, made non-citizens, legal non-citizens, ineligible for welfare benefits. Illegal non-citizens were already ineligible for benefits, even though they got them. So this was a major change in American social policy. And at that time, according to the Census Bureau data, non-citizens were actually more likely to have welfare benefits than citizen households. So the claim that people make that it isn't true that non-citizens are dependent on welfare is just false. They were actually more likely to have a welfare benefit than citizens. And so welfare for non-citizens was basically ended. So since that time, we've had roughly the same kind of impacts, at least if you have a measure of impacts on Hispanics, because the impacts on child poverty for Hispanics have been roughly equivalent to other children, so there's been a very substantial decline. Now, that's not to say, though, that especially for Hispanics and especially children from Mexico and from other South American countries, that the probability that they will be in poverty, even though it's declined, is still very high and much higher than white children, and in some cases, even higher than for black children. So this is definitely a problem, and if anything, the welfare bill may have intensified it somewhat because many of those families that used to be dependent on welfare no longer qualify for welfare.
When you broke up the welfare thing into three parts, Medicaid, food stamps, and direct payments, and when you say that the illegal citizens were partaking of welfare at greater rates than citizens, are you talking about all of them, or just
not just those three, but all other welfare programs as well? Yes, not any one of those, but all of them. They're more likely to have at least one welfare benefit in the household, and especially, probably the most notorious program is one that you did not mention, and neither have I until this moment, and that is Supplemental Security Income, which is a cash welfare program that goes to people who are both roughly below the poverty line, but also are either disabled or elderly. And there was a huge increase by a factor of 10 in the number of elderly non-citizens who were getting SSI benefits. And that came, by the way, with Medicaid. They got the SSI cash, and then they were automatically qualified for Medicaid.
Before, right.
They're no longer qualified. They are permanently barred from SSI and from food stamps. They are barred for 5 years after entry from the old AFDC program, which is now called TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and from other programs that states have more control over. States can make a decision to give those benefits to the families after 5 years.
So, in total, you're saying that I hear you saying that the effect on Latinos, and in particular the illegal alien portion of them, are they've been hit hard here?
I would say the impact on illegals has probably been somewhat less because they already were ineligible for benefits. But at the time that the welfare bill passed in 96, legal non-citizens were eligible for benefits, and they were very likely to get benefits. Fewer of them now receive benefits. So I would say legal non-citizens have been the hardest hit.
Okay, and the legal non-citizens are people with green cards, or
mostly, but there are other. You don't always have to have a green card to be a legal entrant into the United States.
You mean like under a visa or something?
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Well, thanks.
All right. Next caller is in near Kokomo, Indiana, on our line one. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for having Mr. Ron Haskins on this program. I used to be a friend of WILL and quit donating when it became so many Miller-Kom very liberal, very Democrat programs, and so I appreciate hearing a breath of fresh air from once in a while a very well-informed conservative person who has the same goals in mind for all of us, which is the good of the common man. So thanks for the program and the speaker.
Well, all right. Other comments and questions are certainly welcome, whether you want to agree or disagree.
Well, we especially welcome calls like that, don't we?
I can see that you would. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ron Haskins, and he is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and his area of expertise, among his area of expertise, welfare reform, and that's what we're here talking about this morning, and that's what he is here on the campus, in fact, to discuss. He'll be giving a talk later this afternoon. This is one that had been scheduled for yesterday. Same place, the Levis Center. Different time, 3 o'clock. If you're interested in there, it's free and open to the public. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. In addition to the changes that happened in 96 that you would argue were positive, are there other things about the way that the welfare system is structured that you would still argue should be changed?
Well, yes, there are many things. I've already pointed out that we have a lot to learn about how to help these floundering families. To me, that is one of the most important issues. The second thing is, and I think this, I don't have an answer for this, but it's something that I'm concerned about. And that is that we, in the old days under welfare, many female-headed families lived on a package of benefits worth roughly $12,000, which is incredibly skimpy. Mm-hmm. Now those families, because of their own efforts and because of the earned income tax credit, which, by the way, can give them up to $4,000 a year, and food stamps, which could be another $1,500 or so, and other benefit programs. Many states have tax credits, for example. Those families may now be at, say, $17,000 or $18,000, in a few cases even $20,000. But that's still quite low. And the mother's wages tend to be around $7.50 an hour. There is some evidence that the longer they stay in the labor force, their income increases slightly, but not greatly. So we have a huge number of mothers who are supporting children who are working for $7.50 and $8 an hour, and this, I mean, it's not a very great living. So if we could figure out an effective way to help these families increase their skills at the same time that they're already increasing their work experience and move to jobs that would pay $10 and $14 and $18 an hour, I think we would all be better off and their children would be better off. So that's another very challenging situation. And finally, I would mention child support enforcement. Mm. There were huge reforms in child support enforcement in 1996 as well. And we did reform that program. The results are much better, but there still are far too many children who do not receive child support payments. And that's another big problem.
We have now less than 10 minutes. We have some other callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Callers will help us if they can be brief. We'll go next to Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi. How recent are all these figures? And the thing about that is you've talked about our recession being over, but if there hasn't been any job production and we have a growing list of discouraged workers who are normally regarded as people that aren't even candidates for welfare, it seems to me that there can't be an expansion of people on the lower levels getting jobs, and I think that we do this a couple years from now, depending on what goes with the economy. You may be shocked to see what's happening right now on the ground. I just question it. I looked for the Census Bureau's Poverty in America, and the latest one they seem to have published is from 1999. So I'm just questioning. Go back to the other caller's lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Well, I appreciate you giving me a chance to give my version of damn lies. First of all, the Census Bureau every September publishes the poverty data and income data for the United States as a whole, and I think almost all analysts regard these as quite respectable numbers. In other words, they're reliable. They're good estimates of what people actually have. And so we now have results for poverty and for family income that I have already mentioned through 2003, in other words, 2 years into the recession. And as I say, I think those are very reliable data. And what happened is that these families, their employment went down slightly and their income went down slightly. Let me also say to you that the employment data that I mentioned that showed these huge changes and increases in females heading families, especially never married females, the most disadvantaged females, are from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And those percentages are of all female heads. The denominator is all female heads. So discouraged workers does not enter into this at all. I really think that the picture that I have given you here is the most accurate one that we're able to portray, given the evidence that's available through 2003. Now, you mentioned 2 years, 3 years into the future. You could be right. It may be possible, as I've already said, that a deeper recession that had a big impact on low-income employment, things might be very different. But so far, this recession appears to be primarily a middle-class recession, and the loss of jobs has not been at the bottom in these $7.50 and $8-an-hour jobs.
But there's the class of the working poor and not female-headed households where I don't know whether there's been a... One of the cautionary things that people have said about the reform was that it was going to force women into staying in abusive relationships and that sort of thing. And I have a feeling that that maybe is another factor that should be accounted for. And,
well, the countervailing claim could be, and many people have made this claim, that when women are employed and able to support themselves economically, they would be less likely to be forced into maintaining a relationship that involves domestic violence. I am not aware of any statistics that show that there have been increases in domestic violence. And by the way, there are at least two other objective sets of numbers that we have long-term historical data, and that's hunger and what's called food insecurity, which is sort of hunger but less severe, and the number of children who are in foster care or have been adopted, have become wards of the state because of abuse or neglect. And many people predicted that all of those measures would become worse as a result of welfare reform. And that has not happened. In fact, hunger and food insecurity and the number of kids that are in the foster care system in the various states has actually declined slightly over this period. So there has not been that major impact. And I suspect the same thing is true of domestic violence, but I'm not aware of the figures.
I'm going to try to get at least one more caller. We'll go to Forest, Illinois. This is line three. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering about what percentage of the federal budget is actually made up by welfare before and after 1996?
It depends on how you define welfare. The old AFDC program that was so controversial was less than 1% of the federal budget, and the program that replaced it has more or less the exact same numbers of dollars, but of course the federal budget is now much bigger, so it would be much less than 1%. However, if you include all the money that goes to low-income families, so that would be the Earned Income Tax Credit, Supplemental Security Income, Medicaid, food stamps, and a host of other programs, education programs, health programs, and so forth, you could get up to probably somewhere in the area of $360 or $370 billion for all of these programs.
So what percentage of it is that?
That would be something like a sixth of the federal budget.
Less than 1%.
No, one-sixth of the federal budget. So something like 15%.
As somebody that's always worked outside the home my entire life, married with three children who are now grown, I do understand not wanting to pay for people to stay at home, but I also feel that happens with Social Security payments to people who've never worked outside the home by choice. And I guess I don't, you know, I'm also in a profession where I do see the results of this, where people have gone off of welfare, lost their welfare benefits, gotten a good job, gotten insurance, and we all rah-rahed with that, and now they've been laid off and have absolutely nothing. And I mean, this is just a small, it's just anecdotal, obviously not percentage, but, you know, I've seen the tragedy of it with my work in healthcare.
Right. And there's no question that has occurred. But let me say two things about it. First of all, on average, if you look at the nation as a whole, that has not occurred, that more female-headed families are better off financially than they were under the old system where people could stay on welfare essentially forever. So they are better off. The second thing is that many of those families are much better off because they're employed. Their kids are proud of their parents for being employed. They're independent from welfare, and it's consistent with what the American public wants. So I would say on balance, it's clearly a better system, even though there are these individual cases that are unfortunate.
Especially in rural areas, though. I mean, a large city, you've got a lot more to choose from. Rural areas, it can be pretty bleak.
Almost all the studies show that in rural areas, the effects are just about the same as they are in cities. So there have been declines in poverty in rural area, increases in employment, and so forth.
I'm going to have to jump in here. My apologies to the caller, but we're simply going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. But again, I want to mention for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, where we are, our guest, Ron Haskins, will be giving a talk on this subject, on welfare reform law of 1996, this afternoon on the U of I campus at 3 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on Illinois Street in Urbana. This is part of an initiative looking at the connections between health and social welfare policies that's being sponsored primarily by the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus. Our guest, Ron Haskins, is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and they do have a website if you're interested in finding out more about him or the other things that they do there at Brookings. You can go to www.brookings.edu and find out more. Thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. I greatly enjoyed it.